This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, November 29, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. With winter and rising energy prices approaching, Democratic lawmakers turn to Venezuela for help. Back from his week-long vacation, President Bush focuses on immigration enforcement.
We will not be able to effectively enforce our immigration laws until we create a temporary worker program.
They lose in ground, they change everything to attack immigrants.
And the governor of Virginia grants clemency to death row inmate Robin Lovett. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Canada's 38th Parliament will cease to exist today, and Canadians will head to the polls in January. Prime Minister Paul Martin's minority government, in power for 17 months, was voted out yesterday. Alison Benjamin reports from Vancouver.
The government of Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin collapsed yesterday after a parliamentary vote of no confidence. Conservative Party leader Stephen Harper introduced the motion, which was seconded by New Democrat leader Jack Layton. The motion passed 177 to 133. Martin's Liberal Party led Parliament since June 2004. This is the first time a Canadian government has fallen on a motion of straight non-confidence. In the past, minority governments have fallen because of lost budget votes or censure motions interpreted as non-confidence votes. Yesterday's vote has set the stage for an early election. Prime Minister Paul Martin will ask the Governor General, Michel Jean, to dissolve Parliament today. Elections are scheduled for January 23rd. For FSRN in Vancouver, Canada, I'm Alison Benjamin.
Primary elections have been postponed in some areas of Palestine. Manar Jabrin reports from the West Bank.
Primary elections for the ruling Fatah Party have been suspended in the Gaza Strip amid allegations of voting irregularities and eruptions of violence at polling stations on Monday. Fuad Kokaleh, member of Fatah Movement, said that no intention to call off the elections.
There is no intention to postpone the elections in the West Bank. On the contrary, President Abu Mazen said he will respect the results of the already held elections, such as in Bethlehem area. Elections in the Gaza Strip were suspended only for security problems, which will be addressed soon.
Voters in the last week's primaries in the West Bank favored young contenders over veteran Fatah politicians. Imprisoned Fatah member and legislator Marwan Barghouthi won an overwhelming majority in Ramallah area, achieving 96% of the total votes. This marks the first time that Fatah has held primary elections. The long-dominant party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will face a political challenge from Hamas in January's legislative elections. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
An election official in Honduras has announced that opposition candidate Manuel Zelaya is the country's new president-elect. The announcement has sparked political tension in Honduras, as only a small fraction of the votes cast in Sunday's election have been counted. The other leading presidential contender has refused to concede, saying that it is too early to call the election with so few votes tallied. Both candidates promise to be tough on crime if elected. The Supreme Court has rejected the wrongful termination case of an FBI whistleblower who spoke out against security lapses at the Bureau. Victoria Jones reports from Washington, D.C.
The Supreme Court on Monday refused to hear the case of Sybil Edmonds, a language specialist who was fired from her position at the FBI for discussing security breaches that she witnessed after 9/11. Lower courts dismissed the wrongful termination case under the state secrets privilege before the case was rejected by the Supreme Court. The state secrets privilege is a rarely used legal precedent which allows the executive branch to assert that there are military matters which should not be divulged in the interest of national security. Now that her legal options have come to an end, Ms. Edmonds has said that she intends to continue her fight by asking Congress to investigate security breaches inside the FBI. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Victoria Jones.
A government probe into the terrorist attack at a school in Beslan, Russia, has concluded that security forces are partly to blame. The head of the local parliamentary commission reviewing the case blamed security forces for allowing a group of heavily armed persons to pass unnoticed through a major regional air and rail hub like Beslan. Investigators also condemned security forces for mishandling the effort to rescue the hostages held at the school. 331 people died in the September 2004 attack. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Back from his week-long vacation, President Bush is on a two-state tour to promote a newly organized stance on immigration reform. His focus is on immigration enforcement measures backed in the House. Immigrant advocates hope he builds support for more comprehensive measures in the Senate. Renee Feltz has more.
President Bush meets today with border security officials in El Paso. He did the same thing Monday in Arizona. His itinerary highlights a rearranged immigration reform package. Border enforcement and improved security take center stage, while more controversial issues, like Bush's guest worker program, take a back seat.
When non-Mexican illegal immigrants are apprehended, they are initially detained. The problem is that our detention facilities don't have enough beds. And so, about four of every five non-Mexican illegal immigrants we catch are released into society and asked to return for a court date. When the date arrives, about 75% of those released don't show up to the court. As a result, last year, only 30,000 of the 160,000 non-Mexicans caught coming across our southwest border were sent home. This practice of catch and release has been the government's policy for decades. It is an unwise policy, and we're going to end it.
Bush touts his progress, his recent signing of a $32 billion Homeland Security bill for 2006 that contains large increases for border protection, including 1,000 additional Border Patrol agents. But Vice President of Policy at the National Council of La Raza, Cecilia Munoz, says it's easy for congressional leaders to approve funds for increased border enforcement. She hopes Bush will garner support for other elements of a more comprehensive change in immigration policy.
We have a population living and working in the United States, 11 million people who don't have immigration papers. I don't think anybody believes we're going to round up 11 million people and ship them out somewhere. So these proposals call for an orderly path to citizenship for those folks to allow them to earn their way to permanent status and ultimately U.S. citizenship. The second element deals with the population that will continue to come to join our workforce. The proposal is to regulate the flow of undocumented immigrants rather than continue to beef up enforcement, which nobody believes is going to be effective. And if we do that well, if we can replace what's happening illegally with a stream of migrants who could come legally, you have a lot more control, you have the ability to inspect people as they come, and you can use your enforcement resources where they're more likely to make a difference.
This approach is backed by Juan Alvarez, an advocate for illegal immigrant workers in Houston.
They need to solve the problem here by giving legalization to people, and then we can talk about enforcing, you know, securing the border.
Bush shows little support for legalization. He says his controversial guest worker program is a better solution.
We will not be able to effectively enforce our immigration laws until we create a temporary worker program. The program that I propose would not create an automatic path to citizenship. It wouldn't provide for amnesty. I oppose amnesty. Rewarding those who have broken the law would encourage others to break the law and keep pressure on our border. A temporary worker program, by contrast, would decrease pressure on the border.
While discussed, this program came late in Bush's speech. Conservative members of the GOP criticized the guest worker program, as have Democrats. Alvarez sees Bush's focus on immigration enforcement as a way to improve the president's low approval ratings.
They want to start gaining support for the Republican Party that is losing ground politically with the United States people because they are really upset about the war in Iraq and about the situation with the political aides from President Bush. They losing ground, they change everything to attack immigrants.
While Bush has not indicated support for specific legislation, immigration advocates hope he backs comprehensive measures in the Senate that have bipartisan support and stays away from harsher House measures that appeal to the GOP's conservative base. I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News at KPFT in Houston.
Virginia Governor Mark Warner has halted the execution of death row inmate Robin Lovett today. Lovett would have been the 1,000th person executed since 1977, more than any other state except Texas. DNA evidence which may have linked Lovett to the murder he's been convicted of was illegally destroyed, prompting the Virginia governor to grant clemency. Warner has never granted clemency in the past, and 11 people have been executed under his tenure. 94 people have been executed in the state since 1977. Many say that Virginia's death penalty is so flawed, no one can be sure that those on death row are guilty, and Lovett's case was no exception. From Richmond, FSRN's Catherine Comp reports.
42-year-old Robin Lovett maintains his innocence in the 1998 stabbing death of Arlington Pool Hall manager Clayton Dix. Lovett was an employee there and said he saw a man in a suit fighting with Dix. He told police that he hid in the bathroom, and when he came out, the bar was empty and Dix was dead. As a black man with a history of drug use and a nonviolent criminal record, Lovett thought he'd be a suspect and turned himself into the police.
This is not the type of case that would usually be subject to the death penalty.
Defense attorney Ashley Parrish. He, former independent counsel Ken Starr, and a team of lawyers from the corporate firm Kirkland & Ellis are representing Lovett on a pro bono basis. Parrish says the state's case against Lovett is riddled with problems, including the testimony of the only eyewitness.
He told the police afterwards that he didn't get a good look at the killer and wasn't sure if he could identify him. Then 40 days afterwards, he testified that he saw the back of the person's head, he didn't see the person's face, and he only saw him for a couple of seconds. Throughout this whole testimony, Mr. Lovett is standing in a prison jumpsuit next to his defense attorney, and he is asked at that point, do you recognize anybody in the courtroom that you think could be the killer? And he says, no, I can't.
Parrish said 9 months later, the eyewitness testified he was only 80% sure Lovett was the killer. At the end of the trial, an all-white jury sentenced Lovett to death. Like many death row inmates, Lovett could have requested DNA testing, but that chance for exoneration was eliminated after a state employee destroyed all the physical evidence. Again, Parrish.
The destruction of evidence was done in violation of Virginia law that was specifically designed to make sure that all this type of evidence, including DNA evidence, was preserved until execution. He destroyed the evidence, violating longstanding clerk office policies that he was supposed to follow. And he had two of his colleagues plead with him repeatedly and in a fairly heated argument over don't destroy the evidence. This is a capital case, and we know that appeals go to the last minute. But he went ahead and destroyed it anyway.
Polls from Virginia University state that support for the state's death penalty system is waning, and that, when given the choice, a majority of Virginians prefer life without parole. Democratic Governor-elect Tim Kaine is also a strong opponent of capital punishment. Director of Virginians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, Jack Payton Travers, says it's time to stop using capital punishment as a political tool.
Look at the way the death penalty is used in the United States and where the executions take place. And by and large, they all take place in the southern states, where the death penalty was used in a racist manner in slave times to control a slave population. All it is another example of the racism in our society.
In Richmond, I'm Catherine Comp for Free Speech Radio News.
As winter approaches, advocacy groups are in their last throes in trying to get Congress to fully fund the low-income assistance heating program for the elderly and the poor. The Department of Energy predicts that this winter's heating bills will rise by 50%. While it looks doubtful that Congress will fully fund the program, and oil companies with record profits say they don't want to set a precedent by lowering costs, some Democratic lawmakers are turning to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez for help. From Washington, Mitch Jezerich reports.
People day in and day out skip meals in order to pay their energy bills.
David Fox is the executive director of the advocacy group Home Energy Assistance, that is trying to convince Congress in its last few weeks of session to fully fund the low-income heating and energy assistance program for seniors and the poor.
Cost increases that we're anticipating this winter, even middle-income households are going to be struggling to pay their energy bills. For low-income households, it could simply be a disaster.
There are about 5 million homes that receive assistance in paying their heating bills every year, mostly in areas with extreme winters, and another 32 million people who are eligible for the program. The Department of Energy predicts that this winter's heating bills will be 50% higher than last year's record prices. But it doesn't appear that Congress will kick in additional funds for assistance. So two Democratic lawmakers, Jose Serrano of New York and William De La Hunt of Massachusetts, took up Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's offer to buy heating oil at a 40% discount for poor U.S. communities. Representative De La Hunt brokered the deal with Venezuela's state-owned Citgo Petroleum Corporation.
In our case, the government has failed, both the White House and this Congress, to provide the adequate funding necessary to meet the demand. So that in the case of Citgo, it's most welcome because it was clear that there were families in Massachusetts that were going to go cold this winter, and that's unacceptable.
De La Hunt says he also had to turn to Venezuela because U.S. oil companies weren't offering solutions.
They expressed reluctance to voluntarily provide that assistance despite the record profits that they had secured as a result of these escalating costs associated with the price of energy. So here we are, if you will, going to one American subsidiary of a foreign national oil company to secure that assistance.
Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Al Jazeera has broadcast a video today showing two Canadians, one British, and one U.S. national who were taken hostage Saturday in West Baghdad. The four humanitarian workers, part of the Christian Peacemaker Team, or CPT, were in Iraq documenting the conditions of detainees in the country, many of whose rights have been violated by the coalition forces. One of the CPT's cases involves Zaidan Fadel. Fadel would have turned 20 years old last week, but last year, three U.S. soldiers detained him and his cousin, Marwan. Both young men were handcuffed and then thrown in the Tigris River. FSRN's Salam Talib spoke with Nazar Al-Samaria, the uncle and lawyer for the two victims.
The two men were stopped by U.S. military at a checkpoint when they were driving from Baghdad going to Samaria. Then they let them go. They changed their minds and detained both of them and handcuffed them and put bags on their heads and took them to the Tigris River and threw them into the river while the soldiers were laughing and making fun of them. Then U.S. soldiers drove over the victim's car with a tank. 13 days later, we found Zaidun dead in the river and Marwan still alive to tell us the story.
6 months later, and after many complaints from the victim's family, the U.S. military in Iraq found the soldiers and put them in a trial for the killing Iraqi civilians. Attorney Nazar described what ensued.
The military asked me and the father of Marwan to come to the USA so we could attend the trial. We came to Fort Carson military base in Colorado where the trial took place. They told me and Marwan when we were in the USA that the court found Sergeant First Class Tracy Perkins guilty and they sentenced him to 6 months in jail. Later, they asked for our permission to transport Zaidun's body from Iraq to the U.S. for an autopsy. They said they would tell us when they would schedule the trial for the other soldier. But they never informed us of the next trial date, and they charged him and sentenced him to 45 days in jail. We were so shocked by the verdicts because we were expecting the soldiers to get at least 15 years in prison. I ask American people to pressure their government to withdraw the U.S. military from Iraq. There is no reason for the Americans to die in Iraq, especially if the reason is oil. Human blood is worth much more than oil. Still, I cannot find any hate for the American people in my heart, and I respect every single American for what they did for the world. The American people have to defend themselves when their own government acts without their consent. That's what the people have to do. And I hope all of us can be friends.
FSRN's Salam Talib spoke with Nazar Al-Samaria, the uncle and lawyer for the two victims. Medicare recipients across the U.S. have begun the process of enrolling in the country's first government-funded prescription drug program. But many of those eligible for the service, most of whom are elderly, say they are, at best, bewildered by the process. FSRN's Jim Kent spoke to senior citizens, pharmacists, and a Medicare representative in South Dakota and found that there's more than enough confusion about the government's new prescription drug program to go around.
I guess I've been confused.
Well, I'm not too well educated and I don't understand all of this, and it's really difficult for me.
There is too much information out here for too short a time period.
On November 15th, the federal government delivered a comprehensive federal prescription drug plan to the nation's senior citizens. That was the first day that seniors and anyone else receiving federal Medicare health assistance could enroll in one of the plans. But what's been publicized by the federal government as a benefit for American elders is viewed by senior citizens as inconvenient, confusing, and another deduction from their already limited incomes.
With the deductibles and co-payments, and I did ask for you to get this sheet.
They're trying to live within a budget. Senior citizens are Social Security. And for them now to want to take more of that Social Security away if they do not apply or do not qualify for special assistance, that's not making their life any better. And it's wrong, totally wrong.
Jeannie Schief is helping her friend Claire Pelly cope with the confusion of Medicare Part D, the government's new prescription drug program. She notes that unless seniors qualify for low-income assistance, this new government benefit can severely impact those on limited incomes. Besides an average $37 monthly premium, Medicare's rock-bottom price for coverage of participating drug plans can include the following costs: a $250 yearly deductible and anywhere from 25 to 100% of drug costs. Finding prescription drug plans that offer better rates than those required by the government is possible, says pharmacist Ted Wick. But
the big confusion is there's so many different plans out there. If there was only two or three plans to choose from, it'd be simple. But the fact that there's 42, I believe, or 41 anyway, in South Dakota alone, it's going to be a challenge for everybody to try and figure out which one to go on.
Medicare Assistance Program Representative Melissa Wood visited the Hot Springs Senior Center last week to explain the new program to local residents.
People are very confused, and they're overwhelmed with so many choices. And so what we're trying to do is put that in perspective and help them understand that they have plenty of time to make a choice. They can relax and look at the different companies and wait and make an informed decision.
Arlene Seward says Melissa Wood's presentation did clear up some of her questions regarding Medicare Part D. But without further assistance between now and the May 15th deadline, Seward will still be uncertain about which plan to choose.
I think they have made it too complicated for the senior citizens that do not have children or somebody to help them. And there's a lot of older people that are going to be gullible. They don't know where they're at, and they're going to sign up, and then they're in it.
Medicare Rep. Melissa Wood says the greatest need right now is for nationwide volunteers to assist seniors in deciding which prescription drug plan is right for them. She notes that they're inadequately staffed for the job, even with the help of state health departments. Without those volunteers, and with 76% of seniors unable to access the internet, there's only one other option for possible help in understanding Medicare, Part D.
Welcome to Medicare's Speech Automated System. For information about the 2006 prescription benefit, say benefit.
I'm Jim Kent at the Senior Citizen Center in Hot Springs, South Dakota.
Enrollment. To learn about assistance in paying for a Medicare prescription drug plan, say assistance.
From his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Mumia Abu-Jamal brings us this commentary.
What kids are really learning in school. On November 2nd, 2005, kids across the nation joined protests organized by the World Can't Wait, which called for walkouts to support the demand for an end to the Bush regime. One of those who answered the call was a 10th grader named Giovanni Serrano, a student at L.A.'s Belmont High. Giovanni passed out flyers and tried to organize his fellow students to support the walkout. When administrators learned of the plan, they launched an attack on the youth, grabbing him, blasting him with pepper spray, and arresting him. He was hauled into the infamous Rampart Division police station, taken to juvenile hall, and fingerprinted. This 10th grader is now under house arrest and has been forced to wear an ankle bracelet simply for trying to organize his fellow students in opposition to the Bush regime. Guess what this kid has learned about constitutional rights of free press, free association, and the rights to assemble and protest? Despite these events, Giovanni has learned some important lessons, one which never would have fit a classroom. He wrote recently, "Look at the war in Iraq. There are jails where there are people that the government just wants to disappear. They have them there and are torturing them and putting them on leashes. They're bombing the SH out of people's houses. When I first got into this, it hit me so hard. It's hard to go back to living a regular day, knowing that there are people that are being killed and victimized by this system is so difficult. Is this the world I want? No, I don't want none of that." At Granada Hills High, another student was hauled into the dean's office for wearing a World Can't Wait sticker on his t-shirt. When the dean told him to remove his t-shirt because school wasn't the place for voicing political beliefs, the student replied, "If you want me to take off the sticker, then I have to take everything off as well." He promptly stripped to his skivvies and told the dean, "You can take my clothes and my sticker, but you can't take what I believe in my heart." What teacher wouldn't give her right arm to have students so committed and involved in the world around them, to dare to care more about the world they inhabit than what they'll wear to the prom? At LA's Roseda High, student leader Sarah Esquerdo was slapped with a 2-day suspension for organizing a walkout and threatened with arrest for possession of "We Can't Wait" stickers. She was threatened with transfer until hundreds of outraged parents and teachers deluged the principal's office with calls of protest. Esquerdo and another student wrote on worldcan'twait.com, "We owe it to the millions of people that are getting tortured, getting murdered, and suffering around the world to do this. Resist or die. It has come down to that slogan. Right now, the future is in everybody's hands. It is up to us. The question is, what kind of world do you want to live in? Will you accept everything this regime stands for? If you don't, then you must join this movement." The great behavioral psychologist Carl Rogers once said, "The function of school is to provide learning to be free." What do you think these kids are learning from administrators, from cops, from adults? How to be free or how to obey? These brave and compassionate kids, high schoolers, many of whom will soon be called upon to join the Imperial Army to fight for presidents, princes, and oil barons, are also doing some serious teaching. They're teaching us all about freedom, the truest freedom, to resist. It is a valuable lesson that millions of kids and older folks should learn well before it's too late. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal, author of We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations, WPFW in Washington, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFA in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Mitch Jezerich is our Washington editor. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. Free Speech Radio News is an independent, worker-run collective. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.